Welcome to the Film Experience. I'm your host, Nathaniel, and today I'm here again with Murtada.
Hello, everyone. It's Murtada.
And Chris Pyle.
Hi.
Who you've undoubtedly been listening to on this head Oscar buzz.
Hopefully. it's a very podcasty morning, and I was just at a drag show last night, so I may be husky all day today. So I'll be recording with Joe Reed for this at Oscar Buzz right after this as well. So I'm a chatty Cathy this morning.
So what are you discussing today?
Today, well, we record ahead of time, so I'll just give a hint of what we're recording.
Okay.
We will be discussing, I don't know how much we're going to actually talk about that Oscar year because there's lots of other opportunities we'll have, but we will be discussing something from the Titanic year. So.
Cool.
You should see that in a few weeks.
What's the next one that's going up?
What's going up this week? This week we will be talking about Serena. Susanna Beer's long-delayed Jennifer Lawrence Bradley Cooper vehicle in the woods.
Oh, wow. I've never seen that.
You can watch it right now on Hulu. It is, it's a something. It's a treat.
Okay,
but
so,
yes, listen in on that, and we'll be discussing all of the weird animal metaphors that the movie has, the weird accents, and that whole, like, trajectory for that strange little movie.
Okay. So, we're going to talk about BlacKkKlansman, Spike Lee's new joint, which I just saw a couple days ago. And I think you both saw early at critic screenings.
Yes.
Yeah, I actually saw it as one of those preview screenings.
Oh. Okay.
Which was actually fantastic because the audience was so into it. So that was fun.
So, Chris, how was the critics? Were they, did they make any, you know, because sometimes the critic screenings, it's like totally quiet.
You could definitely tell, like, factions of, like, people who had various levels of comfort and discomfort and people who thought that some things were funny, and then you would look around and it's like, wait, why were they laughing at that? But generally speaking, everyone loved it. And I think I think people are really excited for this movie because even this critic screening that I went to, like, it was far more well attended than they usually are, and it was like everybody in the room was amped for this movie. I took as my plus one, I took my dad, who, like, when my dad was fostering my cinephilia, as a child, like, Spike Lee was one of the people that I had to pay attention to per him, so, like, I felt very cool in that moment, guys, let me tell you.
That's so awesome. My parents did not foster my cinephilia.
They didn't recommend Spike Lee movies to you?
If anything, it was my rebellion. At one point, my father said I was not allowed to talk about movies at the dinner table.
Wow, talk about punishment.
What was your crowd like, Nathaniel?
My crowd was completely sedate, so I was jealous when Murtada and I were talking that he had, like, a really boisterous crowd. But now it makes sense that you were at a sneak preview, because those are usually packed.
Yes, they were packed, and people were, like, excited to see the movie, and because you know how you like, get there early, and they do all these kinds of things to get you in, and people were with the movie and laughing and enjoying themselves, and at the end, of course, you know, complete silence. And then when you're walking out, it's like people are a little stunned, and then you'd hear, wow, that was so powerful. So I think all in all, it gave me an indication that this movie, it will definitely be popular. It would be something that people would want to talk with their friends about, they would want to discuss, which hopefully it will. I mean, I don't know what the discourse has been on social media so far, but I think it will create lots of conversation.
Well, I mean, it definitely doesn't pull any punches. Like, the opening scene is pretty horrifying. And, you know, they had sold it as a comedy, basically, in the trailer. Or at least that's how the trailer played to me. And I was surprised at how few laughs there were. Maybe it's because I had a quiet, sparse audience. But it was just a lot more serious than I was expecting going into it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of what I've always liked about Spike Lee, is that, you know, he has full range of tones in his movie. Because he's not afraid to take risks, like tonal swerves and things.
that was one of my favorite things about the movie, is how, like, jarringly bookended it is. Mm. Like, that opening scene, I assume you're talking about the Alec Baldwin prologue part. It's really, when I saw it, you could sense the tone in the room that was like, wait, what the hell are we watching? And, like, I like that it kind of displaces the audience, and especially because it actually opens with that footage of Gone with the Wind, correct?
Yes, the opening footage is from Gone with the Wind. Like, just right before Alec Baldwin appears. It's, like, maybe less than a minute.
Yeah.
It's Scarlett walking across the field of soldiers, mm-hmm. right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is one of the best shots in Gone with the Wind. I had completely forgotten that the movie opened with that. Yeah, so Spike is not... He's not a wallflower. Gone with the Wind and then Birth of a Nation. So two of the most famous movies from before the 1940s.
And you can, you know, just call them out. Two of the basically the two most racist Hollywood movies ever, so...
I think there's a lot of competition for the title. Definitely Birth of a Nation.
Well, but to your point, Murtada, like, those are, if they're not the most racist, these are the, like, paragons of cinema that are upheld despite, like, their subtext and their text of outright racism, and they're still these cherished pieces. And he especially goes to town with Birth of a Nation, and I thought that was one of the more, one of the things that really resonated with me the most is the type of stories that we keep perpetuating and telling, and what is held in the cultural consciousness, and especially because he's talking about cinema. Like, I was not prepared, even though it's Spike Lee, for it to tell the story it was telling, but also, be a little polemical about the stories we institutionalize with racism in cinema. Mm-hmm.
Yes, for sure. And the other thing is, like, I mean, I haven't seen Birth of a Nation, but just reading about it and about this movie, you know, he uses the same weapons that supposedly make Birth of a Nation such so appreciated in cinema, that sort of invented editing, intercutting between scenes, mm-hmm. and he sort of uses it in Black Klansman in the scene that he shows Birth of a Nation to show just how racist it is and how it might have led to, you know, events that happened the year after it was mm-hmm. released. And I thought that was the most audacious sort of part of the film, because he basically stops the narrative, and then we have, like, what was it, 10 minutes of this scene of intercutting between Harry Belafonte and Birth of a Nation, and I'm like, where are we going? What's happening? But, yeah, it was really my favorite part of the film as well.
Well, I'm just curious about, Murtada, with, you know, because you didn't grow up in America, like, here, Birth of a Nation, I don't know how it is for younger generations, but when I went to college, even, like, my very first, like, cinema class, I didn't major in film, but I took a, you know, film classes, and it was one of the very first movies we watched in, like, a film class. And so it used to be held in much higher esteem, even though it's so obviously blatantly racist. And I remember in the class there was a brief discussion about the racism, but it was kind of like a historical aside, whereas it was shown as, like, this movie invented cinema type of thing, so it was held in, at least it was introduced to us in a position of high esteem.
Yeah, I mean, I never heard of it until before, I don't think. I mean, I've been in America for, like, 20 years now, so my life before here is blurred. So, but I don't think I've ever heard of it before I moved to the States. But I definitely saw Gone with the Wind as a child, and I can tell you that, you know, I was in Sudan, Eastern Africa, and still this was shown on TV. There was no indication at all that there are any racist elements in it. So, you know, to my surprise, you know, later on I'm like, oh, that movie. Oh, what? It's really kind of racist.
I had no idea that they showed that in Sudan. It was regular there, too.
I mean, it's one of the most famous movies of all time, right? So, yeah. So on TV, and we didn't get a lot of American movies, but we got Gone with the Wind and E.T., so there you have it.
Well, it's so foundational, and so is Birth of a Nation, and again, to the point of, like, he's talking about, like, what our institutions are built on, and it was just fascinating to me that he also included a cinema conversation in there, and I mean, that's probably not the things that will be the larger takeaways for the public, but,
I'm glad he went there with the Birth of a Nation scene, because, I'd rather it be that that's held up as, like, a takedown of Birth of a Nation than another filmmaker just naming his film Birth of a Nation, which I didn't think was a very good movie, a couple years ago now, I guess.
Yeah, and this might not excite, you know, casual moviegoers, but I think it's going to excite film scholars. It can excite the industry and certainly, you know, cinephiles. So he's servicing all of his audiences. The movie is sort of blunt and really straightforward in sort of the parallels that it draws from the story from the 70s to what we're living right now, and that sort of makes it, you know, clear to moviegoers, so the casual moviegoer can enjoy it, make the connection with no mystery at all, and then, mm-hmm. you know, the more discerning cinephiles can get excited about this part of the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's kind of more what I took away from the film, where people are talking about it's his best movie in decades, it's his best movie in decades, and I don't think he's stopped making good movies. He's made more esoteric things, but I think what it really is this is his most accessible movie in a long time. Because, yeah, like you're saying, Rattata, like,
sure, yeah.
There's a lot of things for people who are going to want something different from the cinema that are going to go to this movie and have a different experience and be excited by something.
Yeah. You know? I mean, definitely his most mainstream effort since Inside Man, for sure. But I also agree, he's consistently made at least interesting movies. Like, even the ones that were hard to love, they're almost always interesting.
And he's also been making strong documentaries for decades, too.
Yeah.
And I think people forget even that part of him.
Well, I mean, it's weird with him. It seems like every time he makes something that is acclaimed at all, people are like, his best movie in years, to your point, Chris.
Like, yeah, like, they're holding the ones that don't work at all against him in this weird way. Like, that's all he makes.
Yeah,
know?
Like, and it's like everybody forgot about Chirac, which was only, like, 2 years ago.
Well, that's
at the
a really
time with that movie,
divisive movie, I found, because, well, Chirac's such a divisive movie, because I've been one of those people that I'm like, Chirac was 3 years ago, you guys, and people are like, I hate that movie.
Oh, I love that movie. It almost made my top 10 this year.
It made mine. I love it.
Yeah.
I was indifferent.
Oh, okay.
And see, that's okay.
The one of his that I'm not eager to revisit, but I wonder if I just wasn't prepared for it, or wasn't the right audience for it, was Bamboozled. Because I have friends who think it's, like, amazing. And maybe it was because in that moment in cinema, a lot of directors were experimenting with, like, digital filmmaking long before digital looked good at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought Bamboozled was so ugly to look at as a movie that I had a hard time, like, being invested in what it was saying politically or something. But I remember that one is particularly divisive.
Yeah, I think that's a movie that, you know, I would like to revisit. And frankly, what I've been disappointed about with the release of Black Klansman is that the conversation, at least so far, maybe as more people see the movie, hasn't included Spike's whole oeuvre, like, you know, the rep scene here hasn't really, none of them have done a Spike retrospective or showed some of his old movies or anything. And I was like, when I saw this movie in June, I was like, oh my God, when August comes around, we're going to have so many Spike movies in all the rep theaters, but it hasn't happened. But hopefully, I think the movie is going to be successful. It's going to be talked about that happens, you know, in the next few months.
Yeah, that is kind of strange for New York since there's so many good rep theaters now. Like, I would love to see... I mean, I've seen a lot of his in theaters, like, when they came out, but I would love to see a couple that I missed in a theater as opposed to, you know, renting.
So if any rep programmers are listening to us, this is your cue. Get us some Spike movies.
Yeah, I want to see School Days on the big screen, please.
I agree with you both that this movie is going to be successful, and I think it's going to have some legs, and I'm very, very curious to see how long those legs are and how firm it will be in the Oscar season to come.
Well, I was going to say, as you'll see on the site later, it's not going to make $100 million, so I guess it's not Oscar-worthy anymore.
Ugh. Jesus.
Well,
I guess
it's gonna be
the Meg opened at like $40 million this weekend, so I guess that's more Oscar worthy than Black Klansman.
It's gonna win the unpopular award. AKA best film.
Okay, the Meg is a funny example for this of this whole popular like not popular, these movies that make money. And of course, a lot of people have come out, including Nathaniel, with the data that says Oscar movies do make money. One of my things, because I'm sure we'll get into all of the nuance of this, but the Academy, when they make decisions like this, don't seem to really know themselves very well, because if they really think that they're not going to just nominate the same movies unless they do some eligibility specifics, like... The one that keeps coming to my head is The Imitation Game. It makes $90 million. They're going to swing that as a popular finger quotes movie, and they'll just nominate the same movies. And maybe that's just an extreme example, but, like, I just don't know if you could... Well, maybe some of it...
It just seems self-defeating, because another example would be The Help, right? Like, that's an example of a blockbuster that was nominated for Best Picture. If they have a popular category, and anything that's blockbuster-ish that makes, like, hundreds of millions of dollars is relegated to that, then suddenly it's like a stepsister category, like Best Animated Feature, where people are always complaining popular things aren't nominated, but wouldn't... animated films be more regularly in Best Picture if they didn't have their own category? I would argue that they would.
Do you guys want to hear? I have a suggestion for the Academy about this category.
I would love to hear.
I mean, they're trying to do a People's Choice Award, right? So just let the public vote on it. You know, let's do a whole hoopla. It can act as marketing and advertising before the nominations. They choose 10, 5, however it is. You vote on it online, by phone, American Idol style, whatever. Then you have the 5 that people say are the most popular. And then, you know, during the ceremony itself, remember when Neil Patrick Harris had that bag that he kept asking Octavia Spencer to look at? Instead of that, have, like, people voting on what's the most popular movie for them or the movie they like or the favorite or whatever, and keep... you know, eliminating ones or showing us who's winning and then announce it. But it should not get an actual Oscar. It should either be, you know, something different like that, the BAFTA they give for the Rising Star, which is green and small or something like that, or just, hey.
A little plaque like Hattie McDaniel got.
Yeah.
Here's exactly. Why I like what you're saying, Murtada, because this is also one of my things that really frustrates me about this announcement, these changes. What I like about that is when you watch the Oscar telecast, they're all about, like, tonight is about people who make movies and people who love movies and blah, 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 blah. And, like, that's, like, you know, the manifesto of the night. It's about movie lovers, movie watchers, and movie makers, whatever. And, like, what you are suggesting would be a great way to actually incorporate the movie lovers into the ceremony and into the awards, I suppose. But all of these changes do nothing but slap down both movie makers and movie watchers. Like,
well, yeah, and even worse, they're making it even worse by relegating the craft categories out of the ceremony, because if you look back through history, The Matrix, Terminator 2, like, a lot of blockbusters have won Oscars in craft categories and multiple Oscars. So you suddenly take out the blockbusters from the ceremony because they can't even win the craft prizes during the ceremony. So it just seems like shooting yourself in the foot.
Well, and a lot of this is, you know, a lot of this conversation has been contextualized with Black Panther, as it probably should. And, you know, we've always talked a lot, or at least Nathaniel, I know you're one of the proponents of this, and I agree with you that special achievement Oscars are meaningful, and like a special achievement Oscar for something that has a huge cultural significance, like Black Panther would be perfectly appropriate for that. If they're trying to chase like cultural significance, that it's like, this is a movie that means a lot to a lot of people, and a lot of people actually saw it, you know, bring back special achievement Oscars, because this one would make sense and be way more meaningful to award a special prize to Black Panther for, like, if you want to say, to use my phrase, finger quotes, cultural significance. It would be more meaningful than most popular movie Oscar, whatever.
Well, yeah, because that's the box office charts. Like,
yeah,
it's already won the year in terms of that. So, like,
and it would be acknowledging what has actually been so meaningful about this film.
So yeah, I don't really get it. And also, it's going to be nominated for Best Picture. So why, like, pretending it wouldn't get nominated this year is ignoring Oscar history. Like, it's critically acclaimed and mega successful, like Titanic successful. They always nominate those movies.
Yeah, and now they'll have, like, a...
Now they have an opportunity not to nominate it. Yeah.
Exactly. And so, Nathaniel, can you allow me to play devil's advocate for just a minute about the shortened speeches for the craft categories?
Sure.
So,
sure, but, I say, gritting my teeth.
You know, just hear me out, guys. You know, we all obsess about the Oscars, about all the categories. We all want to know who wins Best Costume Design. But really, when was the last time a craft category gave us a memorable speech? What we get is maybe, you know, Sandy Powell saying, I already have two of these. I definitely want to see that. Or Kevin P. O'Connell paying tribute to his mom who got him his in into the industry and told him, thank me when you win an Oscar, and he gets to do that years later after she's died. Amazing moment in the Oscar. But most of these are a procession of white men in tuxedos listing the names of their wives, their children, and their agents. It is not a great moment on a TV show. It drags the ceremony down. So if they're going to pick out the great speech every year from whoever, maybe a short film guy who, like, pays tribute to something that is an amazing moment and show us that, I could do without a couple of those speeches. So that's...
I just find it so disrespectful is my thing. I hear what you're saying, but you could say the same thing about the acting categories. A lot of those speeches are not memorable. They're just lists of names.
Yeah, but people want to see movie stars. That's the difference.
Yeah, but...
I hear you on that, and I'm following your logic on it. And some points I don't disagree on. I don't know. Sometimes the ones that really move me from out the night are the people who win, like, and you're going to get mad at me because we talked a little bit about this, Murtada, the people who win, like, the shorts categories or the foreign film categories that, like, come out there and make some type of proclamation about what their film was about or what is actually, like, a meaningful movement at the time, like, and like, also, too, like, for the people who win the shorts, it's like, they're just making a short movie and hoping as many people as possible can see it. And I love when, like, those people get really excited. And also, I do think that sometimes, if it's not the speech itself, you do get a fun, exciting moment, especially in some of the surprises in the past few years. Like, I remember when the Dragon Tattoo editors won, and, like, they totally... we're not expecting to win, and just, like, their enthusiasm and shock for winning was so fun.
Yes, but how many
we lose moments of that?
How many other moments of this were just people walking up to get their award.
Right, and, but we've mentioned several entertaining moments right here, Murtada. You've even mentioned them.
Yeah, and that's my point. They're not going to cut all of them. But if they're going to show us just the entertaining moments, then I am for a three-hour show. Like, fine, you know?
I mean,
if that...
why can't it be an eight-hour show, you know?
Sure, but the world the world is not just made of the film experience.
It would be so much better. Like, give all of them an, you know, like those Oscar ceremonies where they had like the half hour presentations for the acting categories. Give all of the awards that kind of presentation.
What I will say, because, like, I think it is good to have a conversation like this where you're talking about, like, all of the ramifications and, like, what the upsides and downsides might be of this, because it seems like we are being approaching this with more nuance than the Academy did. Because, like, even if you... there's people already reporting that, like, they were never contacted by the Academy and they're an Academy member about these changes, and it just seems like they just willy-nilly just decided these things, you know, like, that it wouldn't have as much of an impact as it does, and I think what our conversation is illuminating, like, here's all of the other small things that would be affected by this, like...
And, listen, I understand the pressure of, because... American audiences do not go to the movies in the way that they used to go. So even though I argued on the site that popular movies do get nominated, it's true that they're not as popular as they once were. You know, like, Oscar movies aren't in the top 10, but that is literally because American moviegoing is about sequels and franchises now. And that, to me, you don't give up, like, the whole tradition of movies just because we're in this phase now where brands are more important than movies. And like, and if you want Oscar, there are other ways to direct Oscar voters to think about popularity if that's what you need to do to appease your corporate masters. For example, and I've argued this for years, I agree with a lot of people saying the American audiences don't have access to these movies and it's a problem. I have said that for years. I hate the release system that so many movies don't even show up in people's towns until after they've won Oscars. I think that's completely wrong, and I get why it annoys moviegoers. I mean, make harder rules for eligibility if you're concerned with the public not having access to this movies, make a movie not be eligible for the top prize unless it's opened in the 10 major markets or something. Like, this idea that you can play in one theater for LA, I'm sorry, is baloney. It's so stupid. I am all for making it harder to be eligible for the Oscar, and then you would have more audience access.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. And the other thing that I think I haven't seen people talk about is that when you cut the Oscar period by 2 weeks, this is actually the one that worries me the most, because that's 2 weeks these so-called Oscar movies, which are the movies that we all like, the smaller independent movies, the foreign movies, it's 2 weeks where they're still in the conversation, people are talking about them, and some people are rushing out, buying tickets to get to them. So now, instead of having almost January and February, every year for these movies to get more ticket buyers, mm-hmm. they're only getting a month. So that is going to make them even less popular, if anything. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, that's the thing. It's like every one of the decisions they've made seem to have ramifications that suggest it will have the exact opposite result of what they want.
Because I'm telling you right now that that best popular film category is going to be the La La Land, it's going to be the Hacksaw Ridges, it's going to be the movies that are already nominated. I swear to you.
Yeah.
Like, they don't know themselves.
Yeah. That was my whole point with listing how popular a lot of their nominees were.
I mean, yeah. Like, I want to see what the eligibility is going to be, because I also have questions like, think of when voting is, and then you have, okay, two, I think, perfect examples from this past Christmas season, that during voting time, they were doing fine, not as much as they eventually did because I had legs, are the Jumanji sequel and The Greatest Showman.
Yeah.
Two of the biggest movies of 2017. Could you even say, because of the timing, that they would have been nominated in those categories?
No, because people didn't... I mean, they certainly didn't know Greatest Showman was going to become a huge hit. Because it didn't even open that big, but it just kept selling tickets.
I mean, they have to come up with a criteria that's not just box office, because, like, you know, they already got the money, like, to everyone's point. The box office is...
It's a reward,
yeah. So, anyway, I really hope they come back on this popular thing. The only way I see it is if it's popular means what people want, and maybe if they make it not the Academy, because to Chris's point, the Academy is just going to vote for the same 10 movies they vote for in all the categories. They only can see 10 movies, apparently. Yeah. So they're going to just vote for another, I don't know, 5 that they haven't voted off in the other categories. It needs to come from someone else. Just do it by the public.
Or, you know, like, I'm loath to say this because I think it would be a horrible idea, but obviously the reason people are saying they're out of touch is because they don't honor sequels. And that's literally everything that tops the box office. So I'm loath to say this, but wouldn't it be more effective to just have a best sequel category with, like, 3 nominees? I mean,
Yeah, I never thought about that.
It would make a little more sense, but I don't think people are going to care about a best sequel Oscar, and I don't think they're going to care about a best popular film Oscar.
Right. It's
because the other thing is, like, do people
stepchild.
Love some of these movies, too? Like, where's the passion for some of these movies that we would be talking about to be nominated, especially the best sequel ones? Like, are there really that many people who just love Deadpool 2? I mean,
well, see, that's
like,
the thing
be
is,
real,
like
people
box
show
office
up to
doesn't
movies.
Even mean that it's popular. That's the thing. Like, did people love Solo? It made, you know, 200-something million in America, which is low for Star Wars, but it still made, like, you know, hundreds of times more than something like Eighth Grade will make, but isn't Eighth Grade more popular than Solo?
I mean, if it, number if they, of eyeballs doesn't mean... the amount of love that a movie gets, you know?
If they want to be honest, the Oscars should just go to the marketing departments of studios, because that's really who they're honoring.
Yeah, I don't get this argument, and it seems like everybody that agrees with the Academy that they need to do this is arguing about relevancy. But the fact that every single year at Oscar time, we hear the same arguments and people are upset about the same things. I'm sorry, that means the Oscars are still relevant. People are constantly arguing about them every single year. That
and
means
I mean,
they're still
if it,
relevant.
If it's a conversation of relevancy and, like, things that are actually pushing the medium that is, like, genre films, like, absolutely the Academy can be doing better about, like, honoring movies that, like, maybe it's a respectability thing that they're not going to acknowledge, like, something like Looper that, like, would make total sense for if they're paying attention to movies that become popular that are genres that audiences care about. Like
a great horror movie. Many great horror movies, yeah. But, yeah. I just see, and the other stupid thing about this is announcing it with no criteria whatsoever.
Oh, yeah.
So
how do you expect people to not be upset when you don't announce specifics? You know?
I mean, I thought the Academy's, you know, the people who run the Academy were mostly from public relations, but they must be really stupid public relations people if this is how they did it.
Right? Maybe they should have checked with Ava DuVernay or something before making the announcement. She used to be in PR. She would understand. Yeah,
I love how the third rule changed. We're like, oh, yeah, that's fine. Like, we have nothing to say about the other one.
Which one? Oh, the...
Or that's really... this, like,
the
kind
earlier
of
date?
Yeah, the earlier date. Everyone's like,
no!
Fine.
No, I argued yeah. against it.
I argued against it, too.
Listen, the earlier date thing...
So awful.
I wouldn't have any issue with the earlier date thing either if they made eligibility requirements harder. I genuinely think it should be harder to be eligible.
And I mean, the whole thing about ratings is that people are not watching TV the same way. It's a fragmented audience now. Like, who watches the same three shows every night? That's when the Oscar was the most popular show on TV, yeah, because you didn't have choice. But now, you know, you watch when you want it on whatever it is you want to watch it on. People don't sit down and watch the same program in every house in America. So I don't know. It's just like, it seems that they don't even understand the industry they're in, whether it's movies or TV.
Well, and the changes that they're proposing, other award shows have done, and it hasn't helped them with ratings. Oscar still has a much larger audience rating than the other award shows, and now they're trying to be more like the other award shows. I just don't get it. I'm angry.
Yeah.
Like, why would you want to be more like your competitors who are less successful than you are? It would be something else if, like, the Emmys were the most popular show more than the Oscars. I could see why they would panic. Oh, the Emmys nominate popular things and we don't. But the Emmys do nominate things constantly that everybody watches, and they're not more popular than the Oscars.
Yeah, and I think they just need to revamp the show. Like, you know, get a host who people are more excited about. You know, stop with the stupid thing when they go see Wrinkle in Time or whatever that thing they did this year. Like that, I know I talked about how some of the speeches sagged the show, but those things sagged the show even more. Like, who cares about, you know, some people from above going to see Wrinkle in Time?
That Wrinkle in Time bit just really speaks to how they think about general audiences, because I remember that bit and being pissed because it's like, look at all these stupid people who go to movies, and like this, it treated them like, look at these terrible normies, like, let's make fun of them. And like, I feel like that's what this category does. Like,
I mean,
even at the same time that I think that they're just going to nominate the same Oscar movies.
Yeah. I mean, really, the show, it's they need to, like, maybe they could have worked a little bit more on the show. And I don't know really how to fix the show. I have no answers there, but it needs fixing somehow.
I have so many answers.
I have one that sounds like it's like burn it all down type of a situation. But like, I think eventually this is, I mean, where it's going to happen, like, that it would be streaming live or something. Like, I feel like maybe the alternative, if you're going to cut all of these speeches or shove them into commercial breaks, also have a live feed for people who might actually want to watch that, you know, that you can watch it online.
Well, I agree, because one of the things that pisses me off about the Tonys so much is that the Tonys used to have an hour that was broadcast on PBS, and so a lot of the stuff that they don't broadcast now, you could still watch it before the main awards. And so I would always start, you know, so I could see everything, start an hour early, and then they don't allow that anymore either. So all you're getting now is these edited things about this person won best lighting or whatever. It's just so disrespectful.
Or sell the rights to Netflix or the new Apple channel or whatever. They seem to have lots of money, and I'm sure they would like to have the number one program or one of the top TV shows in the world for their streaming channel. Like, ditch ABC.
The other thing is, like, ditch ABC, because they're the ones that forced a lot of these decisions. The other thing is, like, they're trying to get more superheroes on the telecast. What are the categories that superheroes are more likely to win for, that if you think people at home are going to be excited to see Avengers win something, guess what? You just took it off of your telecast.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Terminator 2 won 4 awards. The Matrix won 4 awards. Like, all of those things won't be on the telecast anymore. Because you know they're going to get rid of anything that's not acting or directing or whatever. I just don't. Yeah. It just makes me so mad. And like the rare times where they've done costume design as like a big production set piece have been so fun. And of course, that's not going to happen anymore. It already doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, I want that show, the one where they did all the actresses presenting to the actresses. I want that back, and I want it with clips. So make it an hour for each acting category.
It needs to be the Olympics.
That's right. The Olympics last for a week. Huge programs on every category.
Major press publicity cycles where we are constantly watching, I don't know, Olivia Colman and her coach, some previous Best Supporting Actress winner, like,
you know. I love that we're already giving the Oscar to Olivia Colman. I love it.
Oh, I am. I allow myself something unbiased.
I will feel very prophetic if that comes to pass.
Yes, that movie is, I think it's going to all the festivals, right? The Favorite, we're talking about The Favorite, yeah.
It's not announced at Toronto, he said, pulling all of his, like, hair out and pulling all of his eyelashes out, sharp object style.
You know, it's coming from the same studio that won Best Picture with Birdman, and they won to all the festivals except Toronto, so maybe they're doing the same thing as The Favorite.
I don't understand this resistance to Toronto. Toronto's the best.
If listeners' dogs just, like, started freaking out, it's because I just emitted a scream that only they can hear. You guys, I'm so desperate to see this movie.
Well, we'll be in Toronto soon enough.
I know.
Come to New York. It's opening New York, which is my favorite festival. So
I do know New York sometimes.
You know, I love New York Film Festival, except the... Often, I find their selection committee suspect. That's all I want to say about that. Just because they have so few movies compared to other festivals, and then they so often go extreme in one direction, like that one year where they had, like, four movies about guys stalking women. I was like, really? Like, I just think they should have more diversity in their lineups.
Yeah, I mean, this year they have no films from Africa or the Middle East, but they found a spot for two Hong movies, which is okay, one director. But still, I like it. I love it because it's kind of like the festival of festivals. Like, they pick and choose from Cannes, Locarno, and Venice, and you kind of, it's really well curated. It's very hard for me not to like a movie that was chosen there.
My festival FOMO is always Locarno because it just looks so beautiful.
Wait, which director has two this year?
Hong Sang-soo, as usual. Oh, he always has two.
I don't even like him, and like if he made four movies in one year, they would program them all at New York Film Festival, and they're so boring compared to everybody else's movies. I don't get it.
I like his movies. I want to love one of his movies.
I don't even find them cinematic. Like, I don't understand what New York's obsession is with him.
I mean, he has his devoted fans, and obviously he has devoted fans in New York because they keep programming him in the main slate, which means they sell tickets to those movies. So I get it. Give the fans what they want. But also, you know, maybe get us one African movie, you know?
Right, that's what I'm talking about their problems with curation, though. It's like they have these... I mean, I suppose every festival does this. Cannes definitely does this. Like, certain filmmakers can do no wrong, even if they have a not good movie. So, anyway.
Well, the rumor is that Cannes turned down Mike Leigh this year, and he's not at New York Film Festival for the first time in a long time, so...
I was gonna say, my body, like... buckles every time that I hear these whisperings that a Mike Leigh movie is bad.
It's just so hard to imagine.
I don't know, guys. I'm worried.
What? Yeah.
You know what? I'm not worried about... I don't get worried when a festival rejects somebody, because all I do is I hold up as my golden example is when New York Film Festival rejected Rachel Getting Married, which was the best movie of 2008. And somehow they thought Changeling was more appropriate for their festival.
I want my son back. You holding a DVD or a photo of Jonathan Demme. I want my son back.
It was so ridiculous. So that I've held that against New York ever since.
Yeah, well, that's... but which movies... I have a question for you guys. Which movies announced for the festivals... do you think is suspect?
oh, that I'm worried about?
Yes. I have two.
I want to hear them, because I'll
come and they're just based on the trailer. I found the trailer for Boy Erased, very, very earnest. And I'm like, is this, what's the movie with Julianne Moore and...
Free Held.
Free Held, yeah. So I'm like, is it this year's Free Held?
Yeah, and Free Held was so boring when it actually played in front of your eyes.
Because, you know, it's a movie that has its... That was a movie that sort of... Its heart was in the right place, but it just had no art to it. It was very earnest. So that's what I got from that trailer. And the other one...
I had the same response. I did not have a positive response to that trailer.
And the other one is Beautiful Boy, which looks like... The trailer looks fine and the performances look good, but it's only going to TIFF. And usually when a movie is only going to TIFF, it's not a very good sign. And the other thing is the music in the trailer. I just hope that's not the final music, because if that's the final music, that movie is already doomed.
Well,
the thing about Beautiful Boy is it's Amazon, and they seem to be taking a little bit more of a chill stance when it comes to the fall festivals.
Yeah.
Because I don't think they have much at New York. I'm trying to think of what they have.
I think they only have Cold War at New York.
Yeah. Which I think is going.
Yeah.
It Toronto, it did Cannes, and I think it's...
I mean, Cold War and, oh, God.
I mean, the movie that every festival took, you know, we assume Telluride is going to pick it too, but it's going to TIFF Venice and New York, is Roma. So that's the one that all the festivals want.
Yeah. Well, that'll sell tickets at all the festivals. Yeah, for sure. But I mean, who knows if Roma's going to be good or not. It's going to be popular whether or not it's good. But I think if Roma's great, I think it could easily win Best Foreign Film. But right now, people think it'll be Cold War versus Capernaum from Lebanon.
Which is not going to New York. I was surprised by that. Sony Pictures Classics can prize winning, but, you know.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Mm.
I was going to say more about Black Klansman, but here we are, and the Oscars subsumed
well,
the discussion.
Well, everyone say their favorite thing about the movie, then, that we didn't discuss.
I
will say my favorite.
Okay.
The sequence where Corey Hawkins is giving the speech as Kwame Ture, I believe the character name is. That sequence flat out knocked me off my ass. Just the way that it's edited and just the cinematic empathy of it, the way that it put us in that audience with that student group, I was just so impressed by and so moved by. And then it's early in the movie, and I think it kind of establishes why you feel the movie so personally, and I think that sequence does a lot of that, because it puts us in the movie, in a way.
Yeah, and you guys already know, I love the scene where Ron and Patrice dance in the club and sing along, and thank you to Kiki on the comments in the site, who told me what the song is. It's Too Late to Turn Back Now, Cornelius' Brothers and Sister Rose.
Such a good song.
Yeah, such a good, and the scene itself is just them dancing together, you can see they're falling in love, it's beautiful.
Those are two of my favorite scenes in the movie, too. So we all have similar taste about this movie. But I like, in general, I like any scene between Adam Driver and John David Washington.
I wish he was getting more talk, because I thought he was incredible. I loved him.
My favorite part of his performance, it's not that showy of a character, because it's very sort of recessive, like everything is happening to him and he's kind of observing everything. But my favorite part of his performance is actually that Kwame Ture scene that you were talking about. Like, I love that you're watching him watch everything, and there's all this, you know, how much is he taking in versus what he's there to be an impassionate observer, a detached observer, and he's mm-hmm. not detached, and I thought that was a really fascinating scene for that reason.
Not easy to be interesting when you are someone who spends most of the movie watching other people, and he very much was for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have one thing with the movie. Joan David Washington gets out of bed with his afro intact, beautiful, you know... You guys might not believe this, but I used to have an afro, and you never wake up like that. It's always smushed to one side, whatever side you're sleeping on.
I have trouble imagining you with an afro, because I've always only seen you with shaved head.
I have pictures. I can okay. prove it.
Oh, please do.
Laura Harrier was good in this, too.
But you know... I liked that performance, but one of my qualms was the movie tried so... I mean, like, it's good that it tried, but it tried so hard to get women in there somehow that I was like, it should be easy for you to incorporate women into your narrative.
That's true. That's true. And the other woman was a cartoon.
She got an arc to play, the other woman. Well, you mean the, you know, she was fighting against the Klan and its sexism. Like, you know, that's something to play.
Kill me.
I was so disappointed to learn that the karmic sort of perfection of the climax of the movie, not the ending, but the climax, was fictional.
Yeah, I mean, there is an article, I think, on Slate that you can sort of compare what actually happened in real life and what they changed. And I thought it was very interesting.
Yeah, there was a lot of liberties taken, which is okay because, you know, the idea that non-documentaries should be, like, completely factual is silly to me, personally.
Yeah, and it worked. Like, if it didn't work, then yes, then it would be like, why change it?
Exactly. Oh, and I forgot when we were listing our favorite scene. I totally forgot what mine was. I love the scene with the Polaroid. Like, to me...
Oh, yes!
A month ago, which one? Describe it to me.
He was guarding David Duke. He was assigned to David Duke.
Oh, yes, yes.
Like, everything about that scene was amazing to me, especially the punchline.
That was funny to me because he got to mock them. You know, it's not like they're being dipshits and like that's funny, but like he got to pull one over on them and so cathartic.
But also, it was so cathartic, but also the performances, like everything about each one of the actors, that scene to me, they just all nailed completely because watching Topher Grace pull off that weird, like, switch from like, you know, like, one of the reasons that David Duke became the figurehead that he became is he seems so innocuous. You know, like, they were always talking about how he's well-dressed and he's, like, anti-violence or whatever, but he's so horrible underneath it all. And so that scene was, like, a perfect example of sort of the mask dropping for a split second. Because when he gets, like, grabbed for, like, the smile, how his just visceral reaction just totally rips the mask off him, it was amazing to me. And then you could see how just racist he is, like, when otherwise he's being so friendly, you know, in quotes.
Yeah. Topher Grace did well.
Yeah. It's a good movie. I hope everybody goes and sees it.
Yeah. I think it's going to make, like, $40 million, and that's really good for it.
Well, I mean, it's good for Spike, but it's just, like, it's so frustrating. This is why the popularity Oscar makes me so crazy. Is it so frustrating for me that, like, why do people not want to see these movies that obviously generate so much discussion?
Well, like, and this movie's going to have legs, I swear. And, like, to the point, like, it's probably not going to have, because it's released by Focus, it's not going to have the infrastructure to make $100 million. But, like, it's going to be one of the most talked about, one of the most beloved movies of the year. And it's like... Money can't be a factor.
Bye-bye Felicity Jones. They won't have money to spend on her.
Oh, my God. Okay, so speaking of Focus, I'm like, this is going to be their best it's gonna make the most money of their movies, and like all of their other movies look bad, and even people don't like the Farhadi movie, so.
Ooh, oh, that's Focus, I forgot.
I always forget, and they don't even have a release date for that yet, as far as I know.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're saving all their stuff that might not work until the end of the year, which is strange.
Yeah, I mean, that one about RPG just looks terrible. I'm sorry. That we should have mentioned that in the suspect movies.
Everybody. Well, it's not going to any festivals.
It's not. I mean, it could go to AFI. Still.
And everybody keeps talking about Boy Erased. Like, why isn't Boy Erased showing up at any festivals? And I'm like, why the fuck is Mary Queen of Scots not going to Toronto? Because Mary Queen of Scots can go to Toronto and end up being terrible, and it derails nothing. Like,
yeah,
Saoirse Ronan will still very much likely have a chance to be nominated if that movie is trash. Like,
right.
And it doesn't look good. But, like, that's the one that I'm like, that is very strange.
Was Boy Erased announced for any festival?
No.
Uh-huh.
Apparently Joel Edgerton's still editing it.
Hmm. That makes me worried. Well, I'm already worried about
it,
but...
When did he start editing the movie? Because did he, like, film it and then go off and make a couple movies? Because then that kind of makes sense, but, like...
Well, the little buzz and rumors that you hear, I think, implies that he's re-editing it.
Mm.
That it's not... That it doesn't have, like, juice, so to speak. Like, people think it's dull.
Chloe Grace Moretz rises.
Right now. The book is very, like, placid, as,
oh,
like,
okay.
As upsetting as it is, it's very,
yeah.
That, it wouldn't surprise me. And the thing is, like, a filmmaker can make a good movie out of that, with that tone and that texture, but probably not Joel Edgerton.
Yeah.
Well, after all, Chloe Grace Moretz might be right.
Oh, I will, you know, if she is, I will,
I always thought that the point
I will
she
admit
was
it
making,
if she is, but she
the point she was making were valid. She only said that her movie is directed by a person of color who is queer. The other movie isn't. Her movie is more, has more people of color in the cast. That is true. She's just saying, see my movie.
Yeah,
but that's not really what she was saying. She was implying that hers was not being supported because it wasn't stars, which is, and it was not straight people.
Oh, I mean,
she wasn't
really talking
about diversity.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing behind that is that the movie won Sundance, and then they thought they were gonna sell. And they didn't sell for 6 months, and it sold for less than what was spent on it, so they're already working at a loss. So I can see her frustration.
Right.
And, you know, Boy Erased already has Focus. They obviously paid people salaries and whatever. So everybody's solvent over there, and they're not.
No, I get that, but that's why she should have kept her mouth shut, because it just it just looks so petty.
It
you
is,
know,
and
like,
she was frustrated.
Yeah,
and
like,
it's not a headline that's going to put a butt in a seat, so.
Right.
But, you know, the thing about this that I liked when they asked Desiree Akhavan, like, they kept asking her, did you work with queer actors? And she's like, these people are 21 years old. I cannot ask them who they sleep with or what they do in bed. This is not professional. Like, why are you asking me this question? Which is true, like, Chloe Grace Moretz is really young. Maybe she hasn't decided what she is yet.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it does
well,
seem
then
that
she shouldn't be calling Lucas Hedges straight. But, you know. All right. Thanks, everyone. Once
Thank
again,
you, Nathaniel.
Thanks.
All right. Well, it was nice to talk to you guys, and I'm so happy I was invited back 2 weeks in a row.
And Chris Pyle.
Thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
Okay. Next week, what's coming out next? Oh, Crazy Rich Asians hits next week.
So excited.
Is next week also We the Animals? I think next week
it
is.
And
the
yes.
And the wife. Wow, next week is packed.
Yeah, next week is packed, so expect another podcast. Okay, bye.
Bye.